Eye has not seen, nor has ear heard, neither has there entered into the minds of men the things which God has prepared for those who love him. For he who spared not his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him freely give us all things? He has done exceedingly abundantly beyond all we could ever ask or think, for we have the mind of Christ. And you may open the mind of Christ this morning to Genesis 14. It is important that I bring to your attention an announcement this morning, this being June the 2nd. Our Constitution requires that I alert the congregation to the fact that there will be a congregational meeting. It is our annual business meeting, which involves the financial report as well as the election of a new board of deacons. This will occur two Sundays from today. In our ongoing study, we are involved in a Memorial Day special. There are two Memorial Days. There's the government Memorial Day. There's the real Memorial Day. And then after that, there is D-Day. And if we don't get this done pretty soon, we'll be celebrating Flag Day. If we don't make that, there's always the 4th of July. But it won't last that long. But there are a number of things here that we are able to observe. We are noting the mental attitude of a winner. We're searching for a winner. The search involves asceticism. The ascetic believer, the one who is willing to isolate distractions and to make inculcation of the Word of God his top priority, is the one who will win at the judgment seat of Christ. He will also win in time as he achieves spiritual maturity and receives the imputation of rewards and blessings out of his eternal escrow. This then is advanced upon at the judgment seat of Christ as well. So the attitude of the winner has to be developed over a period of time. And that winner, therefore, has to have the same drive with regard to his spiritual life as the athlete does in preparation to compete in the national games. We noted that in ancient Greece, there were four national games that were participated in annually. The one with which you are probably familiar is the Olympics, but that was only one of four. And these fellows had to prepare over a 10-month period, and they had to isolate all distractions that in any way would be a detriment to their physical advance and their mental attitude for the games. This also is used as an example in Scripture for the spiritual advance. In addition to that, there is the mental attitude of the winner in preparation for combat. And since we are engaged in the invisible war, we are therefore soldiers for Christ. And we must have the attitude of a winner. And we must prepare ourselves to do battle in this invisible environment. Therefore, we can go to combat, literal combat, over the ages, and in particular that is described in Scripture, to see the development of the mental attitude of a winner. Now, Abram is one of these individuals. Abram is Abraham's name before he got his plumbing changed. He is a Sumero-Akkadian. You can see here on the map where he was from. He was from a city called Ur, and this lower portion of Mesopotamia was called Sumer at the time that Abraham was born. Akkad is just to the north of that, so apparently he was a half-breed. He had one parent who was a Sumero, and the other who was an Akkadian. So he was a Sumero-Akkadian from Ur. This is the Mesopotamian River Valley. In fact, Mesopotamia means the land between the rivers, this being the Euphrates, this being the Tigris. And this is the neck of the woods from which Abram came. And he was led to an area that was known at that time as Canaan. Canaan, you can see right along in here. This is the Dead Sea right there. But Canaan is not actually noted on that particular map. I do want to do a bit of a review for you since most of you were not here during the week, except maybe on Thursday. I think everybody was here Thursday. But for those of you who were not, quickly a review as far as who the players are, the characters in this play, and also where these particular battles that are important in this context were fought. And then we will move on with our study. Abram has the mental attitude of a winner. And what we're trying to also extract from our study is a biblical evaluation of how free people defend themselves. Is it legitimate to have an army? Is it legitimate to go to war? Is it legitimate to have undercover agents, spies, G2 operatives? Is all of this legitimate? And we have been extracting some of these concepts and putting it into the context of our current Islamic war. And so I want to go through some of these things very briefly with you to get you up to speed. Let's take a look at who the guys are. It came about in the days of Amraphel of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim. Now, this area over here is Elam. That's where Chedorlaomer was king. And we see Shinar here. And Shinar's king is Amraphel. Now, we don't know where Elasar is, but we can assume it's in the Mesopotamian River Valley. We have very good information that gives us the clue that Tidal is a Turk. We'd call him a Turk today. He comes from over here in this little peninsula that you're familiar with today as Turkey. And those people are called the Goyim, which means the nations, which means someone other than a Semitic. And so we can assume he is a Hamitic, possibly, maybe Japhetic, don't know. But he is up here, and he is obviously a mercenary that brings his guys down to help Chedorlaomer out in his campaign. Now, why did Chedorlaomer form this allied army? They made war, it says in verse 2, against Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these joined forces to get together in the valley of Siddim, that is the Salt Sea. And that takes us to another map that will show us the route that they actually used to move into the land. The Mesopotamian allied army came into the Jordan River Valley from the north, and there were battles fought at this location right here against the Rephaim, battle number one. Battle number two was fought here at Ham. That was the Zuzim. You can see that's their neck of the woods. They moved down to this point where they had a battle with the Emim, and then they went further south, which will require us to look at this map. This shows the southern part of the map you just saw. Here is the battle with the Emim. And then they passed up the Pentapolis. There are five cities right here that we've just noted. They had kings, and they're located in the Valley of Siddim. That's at the southern end of the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, as it's referred to in this context. They passed these guys up, and we'll note in our context that the reason that all of this got started is that these fellows owed tribute to Chedorlaomer and the other Mesopotamian kings. The reason is they had all the power, they had the big army, and they were keeping this big trade route here, known as the King's Highway, open for trade with Egypt. That's way over here. And so these trade routes are very important. The King's Highway runs all the way to a seaport on what we call the Gulf of Aqaba today. It's a little inlet that is attached to the Red Sea. And there was a battle down here at El Paran as well. And then they did not go back up the valley and take care of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other three cities at this point. Rather than doing that, they swung to the northwest and went up to Kadesh and took care of the Amalekites. And actually it's pronounced the Amalekites. And once having done that, this map shows that they then go to Sodom and Gomorrah, but that is not what the text shows. So we had to come up with another map that shows where they went. And this map here does that. Hazazon Tamar, also called En-Gedi. And so when they left Kadesh, they came around these mountains up to En-Gedi, or Hazazon Tamar, and they took care of those guys up there. And then once that was done, then they moved back down to the Pentapolis. And let's get this map back so you can see that. Here these guys are. And they've seen this allied army move past them to the east. And they assume that they're going down there to clear the king's highway of any opposition all the way to the Gulf of Aqaba. And that once that's done, they're going to come back and they're going to engage them. Now, the Dead Sea is called the Dead Sea for good reason. It is dead. It is filled with salt and bitumen. It is actually volatile. It can be ignited. Some of this can. And there are even at the southern end of it great pools of bitumen. Tar would be another way to put it. And it is flammable. But the allied armies put together by the Pentapolis kings decided to take on Kedorlaomer's allied army coming back up the king's highway. So they positioned themselves behind the tar pits, assuming they would be hit from the south. They had poor G2 because, as I've just shown you, Kedorlaomer went all the way up to En-Gedi, engaged these guys up here, and then came back and hit them from the north, and therefore they were trapped between Kedorlaomer's army and the tar pits. Now, we've studied that over the week, and we've drawn some conclusions from all of this with regard to how a nation defends itself, and what you are to do under certain circumstances, and we will go on with that today. I want to remind you of some of the events by simply reading Genesis 14, verses 8 through 12. And the king of Sodom, and the king of Gomorrah, and the king of Admah, and the king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, came out, and they arrayed for battle against them, Kedorlaomer's army, in the valley of Siddim. Against Kedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. So they had the advantage as far as the number of divisions were concerned. Now the valley of Siddim was full of tar pits. Again, you can see that right here. That's the location at least. And the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, and they fell into them, that's the tar pits, but those who survived fled to the hill country. Then they, the Mesopotamian allied army, took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food supply and departed. And they also took Lot, Abram's nephew, and his possessions and departed. For he, Lot, was living in Sodom. And we noted the cal imperfect of Lekach. It has to do with the idea of taking or seizing by violent means. Lot was seized in this way. The booty was seized in this way. The possessions of Lot were seized in this way. And these fellows have now collected their booty, and they're ready to move back up the king's highway and return to Mesopotamia. And we're going to find they camp somewhere in this neighborhood. As they exit the area, they move north, and they encamp somewhere along here. And we'll examine that a little later on. Now, the reason for this warning to the Pentapolis is simple. They had gotten into sins that were offensive to the Lord. There are passages of Scripture that you can go to and document the fact that there are certain sins that can be engaged in collectively over a period of time that bring great divine discipline down on populations that accept it and approve it. And we see that in Genesis 13, verses 12 and 13. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled in the cities of the valley, that's the Pentapolis, and he moved his tents as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord. Now the sinning that they were engaged in, that is defined in verse 13 as against the Lord, was rampant and unrestrained homosexuality. There's about a 20-year gap between the events that we've just noted and the destruction of the Pentapolis. There was an opportunity, therefore, for those who lived in these five cities at the southern end of the Dead Sea to realize that they had been given a wake-up call, that they could amend their ways, that they could repent of their behavior, that they could become involved in honoring the Lord by subscribing to His leadership and His mandates. They had a 20-year grace period to respond to this. They chose not to do so. In fact, the problem increased over that two-decade period, and ultimately, the Lord intervened historically and wiped out all five cities. Lot escaped with his two sons, and you're familiar with that story. But we examine the fact that there are circumstances in history that must be managed in order for there to be freedom enjoyed by all. We therefore are going to be led into certain applications to the Islamic war with regard to these things, principles that are hinged on these ideas. Now, Genesis 14:13 is important and brings us to our current study. Then a fugitive came and told Abram the Hebrew. He is telling him about the events of the Battle of the Valley of Siddim. Now, he was living, that's Abram, he was living by the oaks of Mamre, that's an Amorite, and he had two brothers, Eshcol and Aner, and these four were allies with each other. Now, we noted that Abram, therefore, has settled in Hebron, and we'll note a little more about that later on. God had led him there, and he and Lot had a debate about where they would headquarter. And Lot decided that he liked the looks of the lay of the land down in the Valley of Siddim. It looked like a very prosperous area to him, and that's where he wanted to go. He didn't think Canaan looked that promising. However, Abram knew that that's where God had sent him, that that was his geographic will, and he chose to stay there. However, he remembered his obligations to family, and therefore Lot was on his mind. He therefore had a G2 agent in country, keeping an eye on Lot, ready to report back to him any problems that his nephew might have that would require his assistance. So Abram was guided by doctrine all along the way where Lot was not. Please keep in mind that this passage reveals to us that having undercover operatives in another country, keeping an eye out for activities there, is a wise decision. And we will note the wisdom of Abram as we move through our study. The fugitive, therefore, is a fellow who comes back with very pertinent information. And it is an individual who observes things and then reports back and gives information to someone who doesn't have it. This information is high priority data. Now, the question that arose at the end of our study on Thursday, do you believe that this is cheating? Is it wrong to have intelligence operatives gathering data both in foreign locations as well as domestically? Now, Abram, who is the one who is in the plan of God, obviously didn't think so. And the most crucial failure with potentially the most devastating threat to our nation's survival is our de-emphasis of and legislation against our intelligence gathering agencies, which began during the Carter administration. Now, this is where we resume our study at point 14. It would be worth your while, if you have Internet access, to read a rather lengthy essay by David Horowitz entitled, How the Left Undermined America's Security. It was published in February 18, 2002, in Front Page Magazine. And when you receive your electronic notes, I have placed the web link to this article in the text. And you can copy that or click on it, whatever's required, and then get straight to that particular essay. It's lengthy. It's about 22 pages long, but it gives you all the details you need to understand, so that you can understand why our intelligence community appears to be in chaos today. They're not in nearly as much chaos as it might appear. The reason being is that their hands have been tied for a quarter century to do the job that an intelligence agency is asked to do. And we're going to note this for a few moments. Point 15. In this article by Horowitz, you will find a summary of the legal constraints placed on the intelligence gathering agencies of our government, including the CIA, FBI, NSA, and others, beginning with the Church Committee report in 1976. This committee was chaired by Frank Church, a Democrat senator from Idaho. And I remember when all of this was going on. 1976 was a crucial year for me. It was the year that I had finally gotten enough doctrine to decide to do something about the curse. I had gotten enough doctrine to understand that there were spiritual gifts about 4 years before. It took 2 years to convince me, through a lot of turmoil and pain, that I had the curse, and then 2 more years of misery to decide to do something about it. And it was 1976 that we pulled up stakes in Alabama and moved to Texas, hand over the heart. But I had gotten enough doctrine at that time to understand certain things, and one of them was how to read the newspaper and how to analyze current events from a biblical point of view. And the assaults that the Church Committee focused on our intelligence gathering communities were obviously wrong-headed and evil, and were obviously going to lead to great problems with the security of our client nation. Now, things don't happen overnight, so it took maybe about 10 to 15 years for all of these things to come to light. But I believe that they were in evidence at the time, as terrorism through hijackings were very popular in the mid-70s, especially during the Carter administration, and you can recall the hostage crisis that was so in the news at the time that Ronald Reagan succeeded Carter as president. Terrorism has been a part of our lives for well over 25 years. And the reason for it is that there are people out there who hate the West and want to destroy it because they're motivated by Luciferian concepts. We are the enemy. We're the client nation at this particular time in human history. This is an enclave for believers and for religious freedom and for the refuge of the Jewish diaspora. We must be hated by definition. Lucifer will do all that he can to motivate others to destroy us. He has invented the classic hellish religion called Islam that is designed to do this very thing. And he motivates Islamic operatives to wreak havoc wherever possible against Christians, Jews, and this client nation. It is to be expected. And if we had doctrinal people running the country, they would understand these concepts and do the proper thing with regard to intelligence gathering and defense preparation. But we've been through all of that. I'm just setting the tone for what we're about to see occurred in 1976. This is the Church Committee report headed by Frank Church. He was a Democrat senator from Idaho. Now, Church, and I recall this very clearly, was a very officious, self-righteous type who thought that intelligence gathering was an improper function of a democracy and a threat to civil liberties. We find the following among his report's conclusions. It was issued by the United States Senate on April 26, 1976, and entitled Intelligence Activities and the Rights of Americans. And it is contained in what was called the Church Committee Report. We quote now, "We have found that we are in fundamental agreement with the wisdom of Attorney General Stone's initial warning that intelligence agencies must not be concerned with political opinions of individuals and must be limited to investigating essentially only such conduct as is forbidden by the laws of the United States." The committee's record demonstrates that domestic intelligence, which departs from this standard, raises grave risks of undermining the democratic process and harming the interests of individual citizens. This danger weighs heavily against the speculative or negligible benefits of the ill-defined and overboard investigations authorized in the past. Thus, the basic purpose of the recommendations contained in this report is to limit the FBI to investigating conduct rather than ideas and associations. Terrorists have engaged in serious acts of violence which have brought death and injury to Americans and threatened future such acts. These acts, not the politics or beliefs of those who commit them, are the proper focus for investigations to anticipate terrorist violence. Accordingly, the committee would permit properly controlled intelligence investigations in those narrow circumstances. The entire church committee report can be seen on the website, and the link is provided. What you see here, though, is a handicapping of the intelligence agencies. They can only react to acts. They cannot in any way be preemptive by investigating those who hold certain opinions, who hold certain political beliefs, to investigate them and determine if they are plotting any kind of terrorist activities. This was forbidden by the laws that came out from the church committee report. Point 16. The Horowitz essay documents a series of failures by the Clinton administration to manage the terrorist attacks on U.S. interests throughout the period of his presidency. In fact, throughout his entire 8 years in office, Clinton never met with CIA Director James Woolsey after their initial interview. And he was in office for 8 years, and Woolsey was the director for 8 years. And after the initial interview, he never saw the man again, at least in an official capacity. In other words, the CIA director was not giving information to our president on an ongoing basis. 17. Making matters worse was the bill passed by Congress, proposed by Senator Robert Torricelli, Democrat of New Jersey, that prohibited the CIA from hiring anyone with a record of crime or civil rights violations. The types of personalities that were capable of infiltrating the likes of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda, Iran's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Hamas terrorist organizations could not be considered by the CIA. If you wanted to infiltrate Al-Qaeda, or Hezbollah, or Hamas, would you get a young lady recently graduated from, say, the University of Missouri, and send her into a terrorist compound area and seek to become a fish among them? Who would you choose? Would you maybe have to consider those who had a rough background and knew how to operate with streetwise modus operandi, that could infiltrate, that knew the language, but maybe had a spotted past? They were forbidden to do this. And therefore, G2 agents that could infiltrate terrorist organizations domestically or foreign were not available. The pool was dried up. And those that could be sent were not as efficient as those who had been there and had played the game. In addition, point 18, the legislation passed following the church committee report, prohibited the intelligence gathering agencies from sharing information with each other. We hear so much today, the braying by congressmen. Why didn't the FBI share with the CIA its information? Why doesn't the CIA tell the FBI what they knew? Why didn't these guys get together and pool their knowledge and connect the dots and therefore prevent September the 11th? The answer that no one is telling you is, it is against the law. This comes from the church committee report and the laws that were passed as a result of that report back in 1976. They can't exchange information by law. Now, that has recently been changed with new rules and regulations since September the 11th. But this handicap was in place for 25 years. They could not, by law, exchange information. So they were caused to fail by legislation passed by Congress, legislation that is rarely mentioned in post-assault news analyses. In fact, I rarely hear the Church Committee report even mentioned. How about you? Finally, point 19. In 1993, Congressman Bernie Sanders, socialist of Vermont, and that's not an editorial comment, he runs as a socialist, although the Democrats seem to be embarrassed about that and refer to him as an independent. But he is a socialist. He runs on the socialist ticket in Vermont and wins. For those of you who may be contemplating moving to Montpelier. In 1993, Congressman Bernie Sanders, socialist of Vermont, and get this, member of the House Intelligence Committee, introduced an amendment, still in effect today, that imposes an annual minimum reduction in the intelligence agency's budgets of 10%. If the budget is a dollar in 2002, by law it must become 90 cents in 2003. And then in 2004, it must become 81 cents, and so on. This has been going on since 1993. You wrinkle your brow and say, how can that be? Maybe I should repeat point 19. Since 1993, Congressman Bernie Sanders, socialist of Vermont, member of the House Intelligence Committee, introduced an amendment. This has to do with developing the budget for this country and what money goes to certain agencies, bureaus, and what have you. There is an amendment in effect today that imposes an annual minimum reduction. This is in the intelligence agency's budgets of 10%. That's minimum reduction. It can be more. These reductions continued throughout the Clinton administration. 20. These circumstances have been in effect and have amounted to an intelligence disarmament over the past quarter century. This situation was acknowledged when Republicans took control of the House in 1994 by Congressman Floyd Spence, Republican of South Carolina, and newly appointed chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. Horowitz quotes him in his essay, How the Left Undermined America's Security, page 11. Here is what Congressman Floyd Spence said after being elected to Congress in 1994, in the majority of the House, and thus chairman of the Armed Services Committee. We have done to our military and to our intelligence agencies what no foreign power has been able to do. We have been decimating our own defenses. In this day and time, you do not have to be a superpower to raise the horrors of mass destruction warfare on people. It could be a third world country, a rogue nation, a terrorist group. These weapons of mass destruction are chemical, biological, bacteriological. Anthrax could be released in the air over Washington, D.C. That could happen at any time, and people are talking about cutting back on our ability to defend against these things, or to prevent them from even happening. It is unconscionable to even think about it. It borders on leaving our country defenseless. That is a comment made 8 years ago. 21. The government of this country has failed to perform its most basic duties imposed by the preamble to the Constitution. It reads this way. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. All who take the oath to Congress, all who take the oath of President and Vice President, and for the Supreme Court, for that matter, vow to defend the Constitution. The duties expressed in the preamble have to do with the common defense, domestic tranquility, and securing the blessings of liberty. We have had a government that has seen to it that these things are no longer a priority. Whether they meant to or not, this is the result. 22. These failures over a period of 25 years and covering four administrations and 13 Congresses have been exposed as perilous to our national security by repeated assaults from Islam during the entire time. September the 11th did not begin a problem with Islamic terrorism. It was just simply the most recent and the most deadly. I remember back to the early 70s where airline hijackings were commonplace and predominantly by young 20-something, 30-something Arab men. The suspects have always been the same. Yet over that 25-year period, as a people, we have drifted toward the dark side of morality. And in this obsession with equality, we have adopted a concept of multiculturalism, and within that, we have therefore ignored what might obviously be before us, that there are certain breeds of cat who seek to do us harm. But under the multiculturalist idea, we are not able to utilize what is called racial profiling. This is considered to be evil, and therefore we can't do it, and therefore grandmothers are wanded at the airport by those who work for the security operations there. Sometimes they are Arabs themselves. We're going to probably have to suffer some more terrorist attacks before we can have it dawn on the American people that we have lost our minds. I don't know if it worked. It didn't work on Sodom and Gomorrah and the three sister cities down there. They were given a warning. It was a wake-up call when Ket Arley Omer came marching in with his allied troops. They had 20 years to orient and adjust, that the divine court of justice was a bit upset with their behavior. They didn't orient and adjust, and 20 years later, the entire area was wiped off the map. I've shown you here that there are these locations. There's Sodom, Gomorrah, and Zoar. The other two are not even mentioned. Why is that? There are question marks by these. We're not sure that what we found here are actually these places. Archaeology can't uncover them. They know the area from the biblical revelation. They just can't find them. Well, why can't they? Complete, total devastation to a regenerate, a degenerate population. That's where we stand. And as a people, we're not intelligent enough, we don't have biblical wisdom to guide us through perilous times. You are the difference. I keep saying this to you, and I want you to believe it. We need the attitude of a winner here at Grace Doctrine Church. We need people to quit fighting with each other. The enemy is not here. The enemy is outside the swinging doors. The enemy is Islam. The enemy is Lucifer and the invisible war. You must have the attitude of a winner and isolate all distractions to your spiritual growth. You must focus on your objective, which is to personally advance within God's system through the grace provisions that He gave you at salvation. You have to make a difference. And the difference is not getting out there and working. The difference is not getting out there and being a part of something. The difference is being an invisible hero to sit here and make the spiritual advance. Jesus Christ controls history. He is the one who will deliver us, but He will not do it unless there is a reemergence of the size of the pivot, unless there is a refocusing of obligations and responsibilities by those who know the issues. You're among them. To whom much is given, much is also required. Failures over the past 25 years by four administrations and 13 Congresses have exposed our nation and its national security agencies to jeopardy before Islamic terrorists. 23. On September 11, 2001, we did not have the intelligence to alert us to this attack, and now that we are engaged in a war with Islam, a question arises: who will report back to us about the next attack. I did not include the comments that I'm about to give you in my notes. I thought about it and said, no, that's too involved. I'll just let that one go. Until I saw Tim Russert this morning. Now, I mentioned this the other evening. I warned you at the 9/11 special that occurred the night of the attack that the end result of all of this was going to be a limiting of our rights and our freedoms. I told you that. Now, as far as I'm concerned, my duty is to be a disinterested observer of those things that go on in Cosmos Diabolicus, to simply evaluate them from the biblical viewpoint, but not to get too hot and bothered about what happens. Jesus Christ controls history. My job is to keep you informed so that you don't submit to the propaganda, confused by it, become involved in Operation Overthink, and therefore subscribe to the dark side of morality, but that rather you would have biblical wisdom to evaluate what is before you so that it will give you more motivation to do your duty in the invisible war. Now, there are those who are frightened to death the new rules and regulations under which our intelligence gathering agencies are now functioning as of last week, that we're going to lose our civil rights and our civil liberties. The answer to that question is duh. What did you think was going to happen? If you were worried about that, changes should have been made with regard to a lot of things 25 to 30 years ago. You can't emasculate the intelligence gathering agencies for a quarter of a century and expect them to be able to do their duties in the protection of this nation by providing data to those who run the show. So you can get used to the fact you're going to lose some of your civil rights. You upset about that? Well, I am too. But do you know what? That's what happens when a nation is in decline. So just orient to it. I want to give you a piece of news here. I'm quoting from a book written by one of the clearest thinkers on these issues out there today. He is the former Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. If you've seen him on TV, you can see that he has great clarity of thought. And he wrote a book, maybe 10 or 12 years ago, called Fighting Terrorism, How Democracies Can Defeat the International Terrorist Network. And once catastrophes occurred in Arlington and Manhattan, there was a new edition that came out, and that's what I have. Now, I'm reading from a chapter called Fighting Terrorism. Here's what he has to say. The belief that freedom of speech and religion are absolutes that cannot be compromised even in the slightest way out of very real security concerns is merely tantamount to replacing one kind of violation of rights with another, even worse violation of those same rights. I am submitting to you that you have already lost your rights the day those towers were bombed and the Pentagon was hit. Terrorism robs you of your rights. And now we want to say we can't really fix this because it would rob us of our rights. Telling you've already lost your rights. Now we have to do something about it. We have to take more of your rights in order to fix the problem. You don't like it? What have you been doing for the last 25 years? Have you been cutting class? Have you not been isolating distractions? Have you not had the mental attitude of a winner? Are you partially responsible for this? I want to read that paragraph again. It is loaded with logic. The belief that freedom of speech and religion are absolutes that cannot be compromised even in the slightest way out of very real security concerns is merely tantamount to replacing one kind of violation of rights with another, even worse violation of those same rights. There is some point at which terror becomes by far the bigger threat to citizens' rights, and the time comes to take unflinching action. In this regard, there is apparently a moment of truth in the life of many modern democracies when it is clear that the unlimited defense of civil liberties has gone too far and impedes the protection of life and liberty, and governments decide to adopt active measures against the forces that menace their societies. There may come a time where we might even limit access to pornography on the internet to children. Who knows? Many people don't even understand the Bill of Rights, and I've taught them to you. Freedom of speech says that you may criticize the government. That's what it means. Freedom of the press means that you may write articles that criticize the government without them saying anything about it. Freedom of religion says that you have a right to practice your religion without Congress establishing a national religion. There is every place for censorship in our society had not the 14th Amendment been passed. That has destroyed the country. Parents have a right to censor what their children see, what they read, what they do. Schools should have the right to censor what is taught. Truth should be the issue in academy, not freedom of speech. Yeah, we can limit whatever we want to, but the government can't limit speech. And Netanyahu, in that, according to our Bill of Rights, Netanyahu is saying that is true. But if you expect not to swap one set of violated rights for another, there comes a certain times in a nation's history where someone has to step forward and say, for the moment, we're going to have to do something about this in order for everyone to remain free. So Netanyahu goes on, the record of active anti-terrorist techniques, once adopted, has been excellent. In the wake of active anti-terror action by democratic governments in the 1970s and 80s, the most notorious of European domestic terrorist groups were eliminated one by one, including the Bader Meinhof, the German Red Army faction, the Italian Red Brigades, Action Direct in France, and Germany's bizarre anti-Western neo-Nazi terrorist cells. Perhaps the most striking example in which the United States was forced to monumentally curtail civil liberties in the face of potential terrorist activity occurred during the Gulf War, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait in the summer of 1990. Iraq was by no means a world military power, and Saddam's chances of winning a conventional war were slim. But Saddam had several cards up his sleeve. One was his arsenal of Scud missiles and chemical weapons stockpiles, which he claimed to be willing to use to incinerate all of Israel. The other was terror, which he threatened to loose against the United States and what he promised to be the mother of all wars. Even before the war, American intelligence community recognized that which the majority of the world's terrorist networks poised to assault Western targets. The Allied invasion of Kuwait could easily end up being a costly affair, even if the Allied troops won the land and air battles handily. I even warned you of that when we studied 10 years ago. I told you there would be terrorist recriminations from our war in the Gulf. And we did. And he says that here. We were worried about that at the time. There was no viable option of passive defense against the terrorists, and the Bush administration concluded that there was no choice but to follow the Europeans' lead and adopt a more activist policy. It, the Bush administration, ordered a crackdown on all potential sources of threat, which included surveillance, searches, interrogations, and expulsions en masse of Iraqi diplomats, PLO operatives, and other potential agents of Iraqi terror. We did this 12 years ago. For possibly the first time in decades, a concerted anti-terror effort was conducted simultaneously by the governments of virtually every democratic nation, and the result was an unambiguous victory for the Western security services. What the FBI and the CIA and the NSA want to do now is to get the freedom to go after known terrorists, to investigate them before the fact, to gather data and protect your spotted bottom. Are you involved in terrorism? Are you involved in plotting the overthrow of this country? Then you're not going to be bothered by them. They have more than they can do to take care of those who have lurid ideas regarding your freedom. One final thing. At the Jonathan Institute's 1979 conference, Professor Joseph W. Bishop of Yale University inquired into the question of whether the United States Constitution could be made to square with firm anti-terror measures such as been adopted in Britain, Germany, and other European democracies. After all, the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution appears to prohibit convictions on the basis of self-incriminating testimony, which is just the kind that security services are practicing in obtaining and in their interrogation. It simply prohibits depriving a citizen of his liberties without due process of law, which is exactly what an arrest without a warrant is. The Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to a trial by a jury, and yet the British found trials by a lone judge to be a crucial step in obtaining convictions because the Ulster citizenry had become so intimidated by terrorists. They had no freedom in Ulster, and nobody would sit on a jury. Would you? It's a public thing when you sit on a jury, and everybody knows who's on it. When there is a loss of order in a free society, you will lose your freedoms. And people want to, nobody wants to sit on a jury like that. Yet Bishop's conclusion was that even under the rigid civil liberties orientation of the American Bill of Rights, the courts had consistently upheld the authority of the executive branch to curtail civil freedoms where there was compelling evidence of a threat to the security of the United States if these unlimited liberties remained in force. Thus, Bishop notes that the Supreme Court, which is responsible for ensuring that the government of the United States conforms to the standards set out in the Constitution, stood aloof as Abraham Lincoln dramatically curtailed civil liberties during the Civil War. Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus, had civilians in the South tried by military tribunals without the use of either a jury or the normal rules of evidence, and made use of wholesale internment of individuals suspected of supporting the Confederacy, and yet the Supreme Court remained silent. As these examples strongly suggest, the American judicial system is ready and able to distinguish normal, peaceful circumstances from those in which the security of American citizens is being threatened by organized violence from without or within. We have the ability to discern between the two. This willingness to take responsibility and make hard decisions in the service of democracy is the hallmark of a mature political culture such as the American founding fathers hoped would evolve in the United States. Are we mature enough as a government and as a people to manage this problem for the time it takes to do it? Are we going to pitch fits like kids in a daycare center, but I ain't got my toy today, you took my toy away? As James Madison wrote to Thomas Jefferson with regard to the balance between the powers of the state and the rights of the citizen, quote, this is James Madison who wrote the Constitution. It is a melancholy reflection that liberty should be equally exposed to danger, whether the government have too much or too little power. It is a melancholy reflection that liberty should be equally exposed to danger, whether the government has too much or too little power. However, when it came to matters that endangered the security of the nation, Madison and Alexander Hamilton were unequivocal that the authority of the executive to ensure the security of the nation must take precedence over all other concerns. As they wrote in the Federalist, quote, powers to ensure security ought to exist without limitation because it is impossible to foresee or to defend the extent and variety of national exigencies and the correspondent extent and variety of the means which may be necessary to satisfy them. The circumstances that endanger the safety of nations are infinite, and for this reason, no constitutional shackles can be wisely imposed on the power to which the care of it is committed. As I know nothing to exempt this portion of the globe from the common calamities that have befallen other parts of it, I acknowledge my aversion to every project that is calculated to disarm the government of a single weapon, which in any possible contingency might be usefully employed for the general defense and security. And then Netanyahu goes on to say that in Europe, and especially in Israel, when certain civil liberties were curtailed in the defense of the population from terrorism, that these individuals and agencies were forced to go under public review, this for us would be congressional review, on an annual basis, justifying all that they had done over the previous year. And then the organization, such as Congress, Knesset in his case, would then determine whether they would have these provisions available to them for the coming year. Mature societies can come together and decide what is the best logical way to defend all of our people against those who are going to destroy our entire society if something is not done about it. So I leave that to you for your thoughts. I'm not recommending anything. I'm simply trying to put some things in perspective for you. Had you thought about these things? Does this in any way cause you to go over in your mind your willingness to sacrifice certain liberties so that all might remain free? If our intelligence gathering agencies and even our military are allowed to function as if we were literally in war, we are at war, and therefore wartime measures may very well be required. And we're going to take a break, a usual 20-minute break.